From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Iran nuclear talks extended once more. A UN call to stop Boko Haram. Big names and long shots line up for the U.S. 2016 presidential race. New health worries for night owls. These and other stories just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Still no deal in the Iran nuclear talks. The U.S. State Department says negotiations among six world powers and Iran aimed at curbing Tehran's nuclear program in exchange for the easing of international sanctions will continue Thursday, 2 days past a self-imposed deadline. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports.
State Department spokesperson Murray Harf on Wednesday said negotiations have not reached a political understanding. Talks between Kerry, European Union Deputy Secretary General Helga Schmidt, and Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif continued into Wednesday night. National Iranian American Council Research Director Reza Murashi says for Iranian and American officials, the stakes could not be higher.
If this process were to fail, or if it were to fall apart, things would get really bad, really fast, and the individuals or political officials in both countries, the U.S. and Iran, that seek to avoid conflict would essentially become emasculated, and there wouldn't really be anyone there to block the situation from spiraling out of control.
The negotiators meeting with Iran are known as the P5 plus one and include ministers and diplomats from permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, China, the United States, Britain, France, and Russia, in addition to Germany. If successful, these negotiations could end more than a decade-old dispute over Iran's nuclear program. World powers have accused Iran of working to build a bomb and have imposed crippling sanctions, but Iran maintains it is developing nuclear energy for peaceful purposes. Ali Vayaz is the International Crisis Group's senior analyst on Iran.
The only problem is that the P5 plus one is convinced that in the past Iran had some intentions of developing nuclear weapons, and there are outstanding questions that need to be answered. At the end of the day, there is no other way for the parties to reach an agreement other than Iran accepting some limits and restoring trust into the peaceful nature of its nuclear program, and for the P5 plus one to in return roll back and relax the sanctions. There is no other way.
The talks also aim to hold off the U.S. Congress, which has promised to increase sanctions if it does not see tangible progress. However, Murashi of the National Iranian American Council says there are some differences that are extremely difficult to solve.
Iran thinks that the research and development activities that it carries out should be increasingly permissible over the duration of a deal, while the P5 plus one thinks that the Iranian nuclear program should essentially be frozen in place over the duration of a deal.
Last November, Kerry said the aim was a political agreement in 4 months. The current goal is to design a framework of steps all parties need to take in order to achieve that agreement by their next deadline of June 30th. And while this may fall short of Kerry's original goal, analysts say that if they can reach an understanding now, it will go a long way towards reaching that agreement. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Lausanne, Switzerland.
Iran's chief nuclear negotiator Abbas Araghchi says that his delegation insists on having an outline in place for lifting all international sanctions against his country before it agrees to a deal. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the leader of the Republican-led U.S. House of Representatives, meanwhile, have again reaffirmed their opposition to the current negotiations. VOA Scott Bobb has details from Jerusalem.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu publicly welcomed U.S. House of Representatives Speaker John Boehner, who is visiting the Middle East with a delegation of U.S. congressmen. Neither leader spoke directly about the Iranian nuclear negotiations headlining news around the world, but analysts said the timing of the visit was a reminder there is strong opposition in both countries to the deal being reported. Before the meeting with Mr. Netanyahu, Speaker Boehner did not mention any Middle Eastern country by name, but made clear he is concerned over the situation in the region.
And regardless of where in the Middle East we've been, the message has been the same. You can't continue to turn your eye away from the threats that face all of us.
Mr. Netanyahu thanked the visiting U.S. delegation Wednesday for the welcome he received from both parties during his visit to Congress. An hour before meeting the U.S. delegation, he told journalists any concessions to Iran would ensure a bad deal that would endanger Israel, the Middle East, and the peace of the world.
A better deal would link the eventual lifting of the restrictions on Iran's nuclear program to a change in Iran's behavior. Iran must stop its aggression in the region, stop its terrorism throughout the world, and stop its threats to annihilate Israel. That should be non-negotiable, and that's the deal that the world powers must insist upon.
Scott Bobb, VOA News, Jerusalem.
An explosion at a dairy in western Yemen killed at least 35 people Wednesday. There are conflicting reports on whether Saudi-led airstrikes or anti-government fighters were responsible. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi says his government is determined to liberate every inch of Iraqi land after declaring victory over Islamic State in the strategic city of Tikrit. Mr. Abadi walked through the streets of the city Wednesday, calling it a historic milestone. But in Washington, U.S. defense officials say Iraqi forces are still meeting pockets of resistance from hundreds of militants, adding that the Iraqis control the city center and the main government headquarters. Islamic State militants captured a part of the Yarmouk Palestinian refugee camp south of Damascus. Edward Uranian has more.
Witnesses say Islamic State militants entered the Yarmouk Palestinian refugee camp Wednesday on the outskirts of Damascus, capturing large parts of it. The camp has traditionally been under the control of pro-government Palestinian factions. Thousands of residents of Yarmouk fled to Lebanon and Jordan after fighting broke out in the camp in 2012. Nearly 15,000 Palestinians are reported to still live in the camp, where food and other basic necessities are extremely scarce. A spokesman for the United Nations, which does not run the camp, described ongoing intensive armed conflict in the area since early afternoon Wednesday, adding there was credible information a variety of armed groups were involved. Some reports say that the al-Qaeda-affiliated Jabhat al-Nusra joined Islamic State militants in the battle to capture much of the camp from pro-government forces. But a pro-Assad regime military analyst told Syrian TV the two militant groups were fighting each other. VOA could not independently confirm either report. The analyst also condemned the closure of the only remaining border crossing to Jordan under Syrian government control. Jordan shut the crossing after fighting near the border post. Trucks and passenger traffic from Lebanon and Syria are affected by the closure. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
President Obama is urging both the winner and loser in Nigeria's presidential elections to work together to unify the country. Mr. Obama Wednesday called President-elect Muhammadu Buhari, as well as outgoing President Goodluck Jonathan. He congratulated Mr. Buhari on his victory and praised Mr. Jonathan for peacefully conceding the election. Earlier Wednesday, Mr. Buhari vowed his government would spare no effort to defeat insurgent group Boko Haram.
There is no doubt that in tackling the insurgency, we have a tough and urgent job to do. But I assure you that Boko Haram will soon know the strength of our collective will and the commitment to rid this nation of terror.
Mr. Buhari also promised his ruling All Progressives Congress Party will serve Nigerians, not rule over them, and said no one in his government will be above the rule of law. Delegates to a special UN session are urging a more vigorous global response to stop the terrorist threat posed by the militant Nigerian group Boko Haram. Lisa Schlein has details from the Human Rights Council in Geneva.
In opening the meeting, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Zeid Ra'ad Al Hussein said the appalling atrocities committed by Boko Haram have created a human rights crisis, resulting in at least 15,000 deaths since 2009 in northern Nigeria and the Lake Chad region.
Countless more children, Women and men have been abducted, abused, and forcibly recruited. And women and girls have been targeted for particularly horrific abuse, including sexual enslavement. This despicable and wanton carnage, which constitutes a clear and urgent menace for development, peace, and security, must be stopped. Boko Haram's leaders must know that they will be held accountable in a court of law for these appalling violations of human rights.
Zaid said intensified incursions by the group into neighboring Cameroon, Chad, and Niger have spread bloodshed and desolation. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The chief executive of German airline Lufthansa says it will take a long time to determine what led a co-pilot to crash a jetliner into the French Alps, killing all 150 people aboard. Lufthansa CEO Carsten Spohr paid his respects to the victims Wednesday at the site of the March 24th crash.
We are learning more every day about the cause of the accident, but I think it will take a long, long time for everybody, all of us, to understand how this could happen.
Spohr ignored a barrage of questions about why the airline certified the co-pilot, 27-year-old Andreas Lubitz, as fit to fly, even though he had revealed a previous depressive episode. Investigators say they have finished the search for human remains at the site. They are still looking for one of the black box recorders, a crucial flight data information that could help them determine what happened in the final minutes before the crash. When Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe addresses a joint meeting of the U.S. Congress at the end of the month, there are expectations he will use the moment to answer regional demands for a public apology for Japan's past World War II atrocities. But given how Mr. Abe's most recent statement of regret was received in South Korea, VOA's Brian Patton reports there may be nothing he can say that will satisfy the skeptics in the region.
In advance of his trip to Washington, Prime Minister Abe addressed the issue of comfort women, the over 200,000 women in Asia who were forced to work as sex slaves for Japanese soldiers during World War II. In an interview with the Washington Post, Mr. Abe said essentially that his heart aches when he thinks about the pain and suffering of those victimized by human trafficking. His words, though, did little to appease Aung San Mi with the Korean Council for the Women Drafted for Military Sexual Slavery by Japan, a group that represents the surviving comfort women who are all now over 90 years old. She says they think there is a hidden intention in the use of the words human trafficking in Abe's sudden comments, meant to downsize the issue by covering the nature of sex slavery. Mr. Abe has appealed to patriotism and nationalism to gain political support for his agenda that includes reinterpreting Japan's pacifist constitution to take on a more active military role in the region and more conservative free trade economic policies. But he also stirred public anger in South Korea and China when he visited a controversial World War II shrine that includes some Japanese war criminals. Comments by Japanese nationalists saying that the comfort women were not forced but participated voluntarily in prostitution, and a cabinet official saying that the government might alter the 1993 Kono statement that offered apologies and remorse to comfort women further increased tensions. The prime minister has said he will uphold the 1993 Kono statement as well as the Murayama statement in 1995 that apologized for the damage and suffering caused by Japan during World War II, and the Koizumi statement in 2005 stating Japan must never again take the path to war. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
President Obama authorized new economic sanctions Wednesday on cyber attackers. a move aimed mostly at penalizing foreign individuals and state-owned companies that have targeted key American businesses and consumers. The president's orders said the sanctions are aimed at cyber attackers who are significantly harming or compromising critical U.S. computer systems, such as those at banks, major businesses, and electrical power utilities, or stealing trade secrets and sensitive business and consumer information. The Republican race for president in 2016 will soon be getting more crowded. Senators Rand Paul and Marco Rubio are expected to announce their candidacies in the next few weeks. Other well-known possible contenders like Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush are still waiting, along with a long list of lesser-known contenders. Here's VOA's Jim Malone.
It's easy to see why Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush get so much attention. Both are well-known to American voters, can raise lots of money, and have lots of supporters among party leaders. But that will not stop a large group of lesser-known Republicans and even a few Democrats from jumping into what promises to be a crowded and chaotic 2016 race for president. On the Republican side, social conservatives are excited by the likely candidacy of neurosurgeon Ben Carson.
We live in the land of the free and the home of the brave, but you cannot be free if you're not brave. Thank you very much.
For Republicans most concerned with foreign policy, former U.N. Ambassador John Bolton is casting about for support.
The president has no higher responsibility than protecting the country. A lot of other important issues out there, the economy and so on. But if the country itself is in danger, everything else is secondary. I think the people realize that. I think they want to hear this debate.
And for those looking for something completely different, real estate mogul and television host Donald Trump may also be available.
You know, I have a great television show. I do have a great life. I have a business that I love. But the country is going to hell.
Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton remains the favorite for the Democratic Party nomination, but she's likely to get some challengers, including former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley.
Well, I think that our country always benefits from new leadership and new perspectives. I mean, let's be honest here. The presidency of the United States is not some crown to be passed between two families.
O'Malley and other little-known contenders face a huge challenge in mounting a presidential campaign.
Hard if you're not a household name, or at least a household name among political activists, to run for president.
That's Quinnipiac pollster Peter Brown.
The U.S. Justice Department indicted Senator Robert Menendez on public corruption charges for allegedly accepting bribes from a Florida ophthalmologist in exchange for using his position to promote the doctor's interests. Senator Menendez was indicted Wednesday on 14 counts, including conspiracy to commit bribery and wire fraud. He is a top Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Immigrants to the United States often walk a difficult path, getting a job, securing a visa, keeping themselves and their families safe and secure in a new land. But newcomers who play by the rules and wait their turn for a shot at citizenship often face another danger, fraud. New York, Los Angeles, and other popular immigrant destinations are filled with fraudsters who pose as immigration advocates and lawyers only to botch their applications process, steal the immigrant's savings, or worse. VOA's Adam Phillips reports on the problem of immigration fraud.
Because victims are often afraid to come forward or are unaware what exactly constitutes fraud, there are no reliable figures on the instances of possible immigration fraud in the United States. However, immigrant attorney Indiana Porta and her colleagues at the New York Legal Assistance Group, a New York nonprofit, have seen thousands of clients whose dreams of a new life in America have been shattered by that crime.
Absolutely. We see very, very heartbreaking cases all the time. We see so many families who may be eligible to bring over family members or to get green cards, and because somebody who was not authorized to practice law and, you know, may have missed the deadline or did not file the appropriate paperwork, they may lose that opportunity forever. We also see people who believe that they are qualified for a certain form of relief, and they submit applications, and attorneys will provide false documents to supplement the application.
Porta says that if a falsehood is discovered, both the applicant and the service provider are held liable.
But the consequence is devastating for the applicant because you've been found to have committed fraud, whether you knew it or not. And so, you know, overcoming that and obtaining future relief is really difficult.
Consider the case of Zoila, a mother of three. She says that in 1999, she paid cash to a man posing as an immigration attorney who promised to get her Ecuadorian passport stamped with a visa permitting her to travel home and return to the U.S. When he returned her passport with what seemed to be a valid visa, Zoila took the trip. But when she returned to New York, an immigration official at the airport told her that her visa had been made with a stolen seal, and she was refused entry. In the eyes of the authorities, Zoila had committed fraud. She spoke with the VOA through a translator.
They told me that I had to go back to Ecuador and that I will have to wait 5 years for me to be able to do something and come back to the United States. But I couldn't do that. I have my family. I have everything here in the United States. So I went back to Ecuador and then came back to the United States through the border, looking for the lawyer, trying to contact him and finding out what happened.
Zoila found the man's office was shuttered and that he had disappeared. She's now an undocumented immigrant who could be discovered at any time, put into detention and deported, perhaps for life.
I feel trapped. I feel like there's nothing I can do. I'm very, very scared and I don't know what to do. I don't want to be away from my children.
Rosemary Yu of the Immigrant Affairs Unit at the Manhattan District Attorney's Office works to focus on catching and prosecuting the criminals that put untold thousands of immigrants in these binds. Her office partners with immigrant advocacy groups to spread the word that people can speak to local law enforcement without fear that federal immigration authorities will be informed. And she recommends several strategies that immigrants can use to protect themselves at the outset.
One of the first things that we recommend is just to make sure that the person that they are seeing is either a true lawyer who's a member of a bar or that they are BIA accredited. They are the ones who regulate non-lawyers.
Second, Yu advises immigrants to fully understand what they're applying for and to get copies of all documents created for them or filed on their behalf. As a third measure, Yu encourages people not to pay in cash, which is difficult to trace. They should pay for services with checks, money orders, or cashier's checks, and obtain an itemized receipt in the client's own language explaining exactly what the money is paying for. Immigration reform continues to stall in Congress. Law enforcement and community education continue to be the main strategies to fight fraud against immigrants. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
If you are a night owl, one of those people who stay up late and get up late in the morning, you are at increased risk of developing diabetes compared to larks, those of you who are early risers. VOA's Jessica Berman explains.
It doesn't matter if they sleep the same number of hours. People who don't go to bed until well after midnight develop more health problems than people who go to bed and wake up early. That's the finding of a new study by researchers in Korea. It all has to do with the body's 24-hour clock, or circadian rhythm, according to Orfeo Buxton, a neuroscientist in the Division of Sleep Medicine at Harvard Medical School. He was not involved in the study.
It prepares the body for certain functions at an appropriate time of day. And it turns out that eating in the morning is something that our body's physiology seems to be ready for. And then we tend to shut down in the later evening. So if we're eating then, that's the food that is more likely to cause metabolic problems or pot belly.
The Korean researchers compared the health habits and metabolism of slightly more than 1,600 participants, ages 47 to 59. The group was divided according to their so-called chronotype or sleep-wake cycle. About one-third of the participants were identified as morning chronotypes, and 95 were classified as evening chronotypes. The rest of the participants were somewhere in the middle between very early risers and those who stayed up late. The night owls had higher levels of body fat and fats in their blood, and they had more muscle wasting than the larks, even though the evening chronotypes tended to be younger. Buxton says people who do shift work, whose work hours start later in the day, were more likely to have the characteristics that put them at increased risk for diabetes. The study was published in the journal Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Hi, I'm David Byrne.
And I'm Lin Yang.
I'm Aisha Khalid.
And I'm Madeline Eck.
We're the hosts of VOA's Now.
We'll be bringing you stories that interest you.
Join the conversation
every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday.
Beginning April 28th for the Voice of America's Now.
A woman in the southern U.S. state of Arkansas is now the world's oldest person. 116-year-old Gertrude Weaver inherited the title Wednesday upon the death of Masao Okawa of Osaka, Japan, at the age of 117. Weaver says she wants President Obama to celebrate with her when she turns 117 on July 4th. Weaver says the secret to long life is treating everyone with kindness. And that'll do it for this edition of International Edition. Follow us 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Libya has been in turmoil since the 2011 overthrow of longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi. It has had two parliaments and governments since Tripoli was seized in August 2014 by the Fajr Libya Militia Coalition, and the internationally recognized government fled to the country's far east. There are an estimated 200,000 to 300,000 armed Libyans, creating a volatile and dangerous situation throughout Libya. These armed groups have targeted human rights defenders seeking to shed light on and address human rights violations and abuses. According to a recent report released by the United Nations Support Mission in Libya, attacks, including killings, abductions, torture, and other ill-treatment, unlawful deprivation of liberty, and death threats against rights workers have been documented since the escalation of fighting began in May 2014. Most recently, prominent civil society activist Entassar al-Hassari was shot dead in Tripoli. Her body and that of her aunt were found in the trunk of her car on February 23rd. Two members of the National Commission for Human Rights Libya, a human rights NGO, were abducted on February 13th and 14th in central Tripoli. Both have since been released, but other human rights defenders and members of civil society remain missing or have gone into hiding. Given the increased dangers, many Libyan human rights workers have fled the country, fallen silent, or have been forced to work in secret at great risk to themselves. The deepening security and political crisis in Libya has resulted in the disintegration of rule of law, paralyzing these and other efforts to prevent such attacks from occurring. Efforts to investigate these cases of targeted attacks against rights defenders have been met with threats and, in some cases, abduction of members of the judiciary. It is critical for Libya to resume building state institutions, particularly law enforcement agencies and the overall justice system. It is also necessary for all sides to condemn attacks against civil society members. The report calls on neighboring countries and the international community to ensure the protection of Libyan human rights defenders, including by issuing emergency visas and providing temporary shelter. Libyan authorities and those with effective control on the ground must immediately take action to stop attacks on human rights defenders and create an environment for them to conduct their indispensable work for the protection and promotion of human rights in Libya.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.